Hello, my name's Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust, so you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's One Another. The date today is the 8th of October 2009 and the time is 2:20 p.m. I can please ask you to say your name, your age and where you're from.
My name is Rachel Denton, I'm 46 years old and I'm from Lincolnshire.
And how are you today?
I'm very well, very relaxed now. I've been here for a couple of hours, I got here early, so now I'm very relaxed.
What was it that motivated you to apply to be part of One Another?
I'd heard about it and thought it was very interesting, but never thought about applying. And then on the first or the second day, I saw the plinth, and my first thought was about the Stylites. Now, the Stylites were pillar hermits. They lived in Syria in the 5th to the 7th century, and they lived all their lives on pillars. And I just thought, we've got to see a Stylite up there. So I waited. I waited a couple of months to see if anybody was going to be a Stylite, and it was apparent that nobody was jumping at the opportunity, because I'm a hermit myself. So it sort of tied in with my vocation and my my experiences and my understanding of different ways of living the Christian faith. So in the end, I put my name down and thought, well, you know, at least there's an opportunity of somebody being up there and doing it. And then I was picked, and I thought again about whether or not I really wanted to do it. And I decided I did. I emailed the bishop and said, you know, because he's in charge of me, and said, would it be okay to have a hermit up there? And he said, go for it. So that was it.
What do you mean the bishop's in charge of you?
I've taken, I'm like a nun in the Roman Catholic Church, so I've taken vows of poverty, chastity and obedience. And although my obedience is to God, ultimately, the bishop is, if you like, his delegate on earth. He's the guy that I took my vows to, my profession, which was 3 years ago. So.
And what does being a hermit involve?
As I say, it's basically being a nun, so it's a contemplative life, but it's I live on my own, so it's a very solitary life. So the traditional vows for a nun are poverty, chastity and obedience, as I say, and I've interpreted them as simplicity, solitude and silence. So I live on my own and I stay in the hermitage insofar as I can. I mean, obviously, for practical reasons, I have to come out. And my life is dedicated to prayer, which doesn't mean being on your knees all the time, but it means living very prayerfully, very trying to live in the moment, trying to dedicate everything to God and taking it very slowly and consciously, awarely that this is God's gift. I mean, ultimately, it's a life of gratitude. It's a life of thanksgiving for the gift of being alive.
Yeah. What motivated you to take this path?
To be a hermit? Yeah. When I was quite young, I wanted to be a nun, and I went on and off that. In the end, I joined the Carmelites very shortly after I left university. And it was a very interesting year. I only stayed a year, but living with 16 other women is quite a difficult thing to do, and it really wasn't for me. I found it very claustrophobic. So I left. It was difficult leaving, but I left. And for 15 years, I was a teacher, and I sort of made my way up the ranks and ended up as deputy head of a secondary school down in Cambridge. And then the opportunity came for another career move, and for a few years previous to that, I'd been very seriously thinking about hermitage, because one of the reasons I left Carmel was, although I wanted the life of prayer and the life of a life with everything taken out of it apart from being alive, in a sense, and that was what I went to Carmel for, and I couldn't find it in Carmel because, as I say, I found it too claustrophobic. And I was beginning to think about hermitage when I left Carmel. But it's very difficult to be a hermit because you've got to be self-sufficient and yet you don't want to be going out to work. And so it's a real tension. because nobody's out there sort of supporting you, nobody's paying for you. So anyway, I was in the fortunate position of being able to sell my house in Cambridge and move to Lincolnshire, and I could afford to do that, and I could afford to take very low paid jobs, which were not so distracting, as to obviously teaching is a very distracting job. So I could take very low paid jobs, and I could use my calligraphy for a bit of income, that sort of thing. And it was just really an opportunity. A lot of things came together. My advisor said this was a good time. The opportunity came, as I say, for a career move, and I was financially in a position to be able to do it. But it was something, it's always been there. I've always wanted to live the life of the hermitage. It's a very hidden, apart from today, it's a very hidden life. It's a life that's, it's a life of prayer. It's a life of thanksgiving in Christ. If I say it's a Eucharistic life, that's quite a Catholic term. It's a Greek word, and it means thanksgiving. It's a life which celebrates everything that's to do with being alive, and that means the difficult things and the hard things and the griefs, and it just embraces it all in a very, very, very simple way and gives it back to God and says, this was worth it, you know, this was worth it for your sake, it was worth being alive, and thank you for the experience, you know.
How do you spend your time?
I get up fairly early and I pray for a couple of hours. There's an old breakfast, that sort of thing. And then I'm working most of the morning, usually in the calligraphy workshop or in the garden. I'm self-sufficient. So I have a couple of hours over lunch. Some of it is prayer, some of it is just relaxing, some of it is obviously having my lunch. And then in the afternoon I have about another 3 hours work, and then in the evening there's about another 2 hours prayer. And that includes things like the Divine Office, which is something that all consecrated people in the Catholic Church and priests, it's the prayer of the Church, so we all say it. No matter what your circumstance, whether you're in a monastery or a priest in a presbytery or a hermit in a hermitage, we all say it. This last summer and the big end of the summer before, I've been doing the vigil office as well, which is really lovely. So I get up in the middle of the night for an hour and pray then as well, and that's really been a lovely experience because it's much more focus. There's no temptation to run off and do anything else, and it's very quiet, and it's a time which wouldn't be there if you weren't up doing it, and so it's entirely concentrated, it's entirely gifted, if you like. Yeah.
How do your family and friends feature in your life?
Oh, they're very important. My family have been very supportive, so have most of my friends been very supportive of what I'm doing. My family in very practical ways. My dad pays the petrol bill, you know. I don't go out that often, but if even so, it's because I earn so little, it's a significant part of when I do go out. So he pays for that. That's just one thing, but that's fairly typical of how they've supported me. My friends know that, they knew before I went in that I suppose I wasn't run of the mill, that there was something slightly odd about me. So they've coped really well with it, and some of them are 100% behind it, but there is always a sort of attention between the Rachel that they thought they knew and the Rachel that seems to be separated from them and seems to be acting without regard to them, and that's a tension which is taking years to just explore and resolve, really. But it is happening slowly. There's a growing understanding, them of me and me of their position as well. It's quite slow, but it's quite graceful. So yeah.
Is there a difference between your solitude in with your faith? How often do you see your family and friends, with solitude being part of your
okay life? Yeah, my family a couple of times a year. It's my parents' golden this year, so I was there for that. And with the calligraphy stuff, very much part of the preparation, because of course there was lots of cards to put together, and then we presented them with a book which I was in charge of, you know, so I got lots of stuff from other people and put it all together. So there's a lot that can be done without having to see people, you know, every other day. So family a couple of times a year, I'd say. And friends, my closest friends probably a couple of times a year, once or twice a year. But it's the next rung down that don't see that much of me. It's the ones that you'd probably say were good friends, but I actually don't see much of them, and they don't see much of me.
And how do you find it emotionally, your lifestyle?
Well, I'm made for it, you know. I mean, I know a lot of people say, oh, I could do with some of that when you say it. And that's absolutely, lots of people, there's a bit of the hermit in most people. But most people wouldn't choose to do it all the time, all the year, every year. I it's natural to me. I don't have an issue with solitude. I enjoy it. Never mind what it might be spiritually, I actively enjoy it. So that's not a problem. And I do have very close friends that are on the end of a phone or on the end of an email when things get tough. So I'm not without support. I mean, there's a sort of, usually in this situation you would have a very specific spiritual director, and I started off with one, and I mean he's a great friend, he's very dear to me. But after a while, it became apparent that actually that wasn't entirely useful. And so instead, there's about four or five people, and they know who they are, and they've been asked quite specifically. And when things just get a bit weird, you know, which is inevitable if you're living on your own, then they know to talk straight to me. You know, they know that... I'm not into, you know, beating about the bush. I want to know, is this idea completely off the wall, or am I actually, you know, is there some grace in it, if you like? And that's been absolutely brilliant, because of course you can try two or three, not to get the answer that you want, but just to get a wider range, and then that enables you to sort of find the right way through things. So yeah.
And today. Could you talk a little about your idea for the plinth, and your knowledge of the history of this, of the period that you're going to represent with the people on the pillars?
Okay then, right, the Stylites. I mean, I don't know a huge amount about them. They lived in Syria, and they were there were some women, but the ones that are recorded are mainly guys. And they were trying to live as hermits and finding it really quite difficult because people kept following them. So they built these pillars, and they went and sat on them, and it kept them separated from the people. I mean, they needed to be supported because there isn't much grows on a pillar. So they'd have disciples who would pass them baskets of food and sort of help them practically. But their life was quite removed and quite separate and quite focused on prayer. That was what they were there for. And so there was no question of them being invited to a party or, you know, getting involved in stuff. That was what they were doing. And so it was a real statement for them. I mean, it's quite amusing if you read about them. These pillars, they started off just a metre or so high, and it was just a case of, I'm going to stay here, I'm not going anywhere. And some of them chained themselves to the pillars, you know, like suffragettes almost. And it was a case of, I'm staying in this spot. And then people came and still kept on poking them or whatever, you know, and trying to engage them in conversation. So they built the pillars higher and higher and higher. And you know, you hear about them being 20, 30 metres high, these pillars, and you wonder how they got up on them in the first place. It's really quite a fascinating history. And then they'd move their pillar and go somewhere else because there was too many people where they were. I'm going to be very, very quiet today. I'm just going to be praying for prisoners because I wanted to go up there and pray because that's what I do. But I didn't just want to pray generally. I wanted to be quite focused, and I was looking for a group of people that wouldn't have the opportunity, and the prisoners were the obvious ones. You know, that they, it's part of our community, part of society, that's hidden, for the most part. And I just wanted to say, we know you're there. You know, we know you're there. We know you can't be up here, but we want you to know that we're thinking of you. And that's why I chose the prisoners to pray for.
And can I ask you to say a little bit about your upbringing?
Oh, Catholic through and through, family of six, Catholic mother, Catholic father. What more need I say? Catholic schools all the way through, Catholic primary school, all girls Catholic secondary school. Member of the Catholic chaplaincy at university. So, I mean, yeah, break me in half and you'll see Catholic. there's nothing more really to be said about Catholic. An interesting family though, six girls, six boys. I'm number three, so I'm the last of the girls. And all very... I mean, it's a reflection on my parents, I think, that we're so diverse now in what we do, and have worked and bent so many rules that are to do with the Catholic faith. And my parents are very devout and very, very... it's very important to them, and they have difficulty with rule breaking or bending, and yet they haven't, you know, they've supported us all in all the weird and wonderful things we've done. And I think it's a real tribute to them that, you know, they might not consider us to be a tribute to them, but I think we are, you know. Yeah.
What did you study at university?
Microelectronics and microprocessor applications. University of Newcastle upon Tyne, 81 to 1985, I think. I took a year out in the middle to go to Northampton, and I was a lift engineer for a year and spent most of it on top of lifts, testing them, which was great fun. But I had Carmel in the back of my mind even then, so it was, yeah.
And did you go into that field of work at all?
No, just the 1 year of experience, yeah. And then I went straight to Carmel from university, and then into teaching from Carmel, so, yeah.
And how was your experience being a teacher?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I was surprised to find how... The first few years were quite difficult, and then I went into a special school and started teaching science to special kids, and I loved those 7 years. I was there for 7 years. It was the longest job I held, and I really very much enjoyed that. And then I went back into mainstream, but as a special needs teacher. So I used to be a science teacher, and I'd sort of transferred over to special. And from then, I went into more managerial posts, so senior teacher and then deputy head. And I really enjoyed the sort of the management side of things. But the expectations that are placed on teachers are so, so tremendous, you know, that the stresses and the strains are quite incredible. And you look around at your colleagues that you're trying to deal with your own stresses and strains, and you're trying to help them with theirs, and I think to a huge extent it's taken for granted. I think that it's a very, very difficult job, and I have huge admiration for the people that do it brilliantly, the people for whom it is a real vocation. I don't think for me it ever was. It was a job I was quite good at, but it was never a vocation thing. And I think part of the difficulty is that the authorities look at the people for whom it is a vocation, who are inspirational to the children, and expect everybody to be like that. And actually, it's not a gift that everybody has. And working very, very, very hard of it is all that most teachers can do. And because you have this bright, shining light of inspiration, you know, held in front of you, a lot of teachers feel a lot of time that they're failing. And I think it's such a shame, because they are doing a very, very good job. But the benchmark has been set so high, in their mind at least, that it's almost impossible to reach it. So it's a shame, because they shouldn't feel as though they're failing, and yet they do.
Do you think your becoming a hermit has changed you as a person?
It's made me more myself. So I'm much more relaxed. When I was a teacher, I'd never dream of doing this, you know. But now I can, because I know I'm going back to the silence and the solitude. And it's like having your feet very firmly rooted somewhere. It's like having a home, which means you can come out of it occasionally. So yes, I go out, when I do go out socially, like my parents' golden wedding, that sort of thing, people are always very surprised at how gregarious I am. But I wasn't before I was a hermit. So, you know, it's born of that confidence that I can go back again.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you do calligraphy. Can I ask you about that?
Yes. I did a little bit of calligraphy before I was a hermit, and I was looking for a way of earning money from the hermitage, and it seemed an obvious thing to explore further. So I took a few more classes and started it's basically a greetings cards business, www.stcuthbertshouse.co.uk. Okay. And I produce these greetings cards, and there's a bit of an income from it, which is great. But it's also a way of, it's that slowing down thing of the hermitage again, that there's so many words around all the time, and I can spend days with a very few words and try and present them in a way which is true to them in some sense, and maybe it'll speak to somebody else as well. So it's about that savouring, if you like, savouring of the moment, savouring of the word, letting it be itself. It's a good thing to do. I enjoy it.
Who are you doing this for today, taking part in one another?
Oh, I haven't thought of that. For myself, because it was something that I thought, I've got to do that. For the prisoners, because I suppose I very much feel their separation and want them to be part of it. I want them to be acknowledged as part of it. And I suppose possibly for the contemplative life in general. Not for the nuns and that sort of thing, but just to say to people that there's a guy called Father Ralph Verney, and he said that there's a hermit in everybody, and it's the church's responsibility that everybody has the opportunity to touch hermitage, even if it's only with the tip of their little finger. And there's that sense of, just let people see, just let them be aware, even if it's only subconsciously, and the limited number of people that are going to see this, but it's just saying, this is possible, you know, this is happening. And one of the sort of the motifs, if you like, of hermitage, rather strangely, is hospitality. And it's born because the first hermits lived in the desert. And so if somebody came and knocked on on your hut door and asked for a glass of water. You didn't turn them away because, of course, they would die. And there's this sense that it might be a drop of water, a drop of refreshment to somebody who can't see anything, for somebody who is just so thirsty that they're dying. And it's not much, but it might be a drop of water. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to say or to convey about your taking part in the...
I think you've asked brilliant questions, I really do. So no, I think you've dragged it all out of me.
Have you got any hopes or fears or expectations about your hour on Plinth?
I think it'll be misunderstood. I think that's inevitable. But I'm not sure that's a fear. I think I faced that in those first couple of hours when I was trying to decide whether or not to do it. So I suppose it's more of an expectation than a fear. And maybe this sort of talk and maybe what I put in my profile will help to explain it to people, but it will be misunderstood. And there'll be people out there saying, what's a hermit doing on the plinth? And there'll be people out there, you know, because I'm going to be making a cross out of my walking stick and the plinth pole. Because that was quite nice as well. I wanted to sort of consecrate the plinth, in a sense, you know, to actually make something of what's already there. So it's quite nice to make the cross in that way rather than import it and then take it away again. So even when I go, part of the cross will still be there. And I kind of like that.
Thank you very much.